This is The Takeaway for Tuesday, January 30th, 2018.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's good to have you with us on this State of the Union Tuesday. President Trump's State of the Union address is tonight, the very first of his presidency. It's expected to be heavy on the economy. And we want to know, is the economy working for you?
Michael from Centerville, Utah. As a disabled person dependent on Social Security, the fact Congress denied raises for three of the past 5 years does not work for me or for millions of others.
This is Lita from Silver Creek, New York. I feel that my investments have done well in the past year, but I believe it's due to the work of President Obama and his administration.
This is Nikki from Arlington, Texas. The economy seems stagnant for those of us on the lower end of the socioeconomic ladder, specifically in trade fields.
Your voices on the state of the economy in early 2018.
This is Jane calling from San Rafael, California. My expectation is that I am loving the boom and expecting the crash. It happens. I don't want to be surprised, so I'm just expecting it.
Jane from California feeling wary there. Meanwhile, some of you are feeling a lot better.
This is Anne from New Jersey. We have a modest retirement investment portfolio. I'm a teacher, my husband is a first responder, and we've seen it make some nice growth. If the economy continues to grow as it has over the past year, we believe we'll be able to fund a modest retirement starting in our 60s. That's a much more hopeful outlook than we had just a few years ago.
Hello, my name is Trent. I'm calling from Fairfield, California. I've definitely saw an uptick in my 401k performance.
Well, President Trump isn't the first president to take credit for the economy. He likes to own it when companies get that photo op, giving bonuses to workers after the tax cuts were signed. And he tweets all the time about the booming stock market as his administration rolls back regulations. The president will almost certainly talk a lot about the economy tonight, but Americans watching on TV in prime time, did they have a sense that the economy is working for them? Charlie Herman is business editor for WNYC. Hi, Charlie.
Hey, Todd.
Well, Charlie, we just got a real mix of feelings about the state of the economy from Takeaway listeners. You heard it there. Do we have any sense how Americans are feeling about the economy broadly? And then we're going to talk about people's personal finances. But what about people's perception of the broad economy?
Well, I'd say right now that one of the measures is something called consumer confidence, and that is at a 17-year high. So that's an indicator of how people are feeling about their own situation, about the economy in general. And I would say that if you just look at the numbers that are out there, they're all looking very good. You know, you have unemployment at the lowest rate that it's been at in 17 years. You have a stock market that's hitting at record levels. You have an economy that has been growing now for several years. So if you look at where things are at right now, there's a lot of reasons to be optimistic about where the economy is going, and not just here in the United States, but really around the world.
Now, let's talk about some of those points. How about unemployment, Charlie? You just mentioned it. 4.1%, pretty close to what they call full employment. What does that number tell us about the true health of the economy?
What that says is that there is a strong likelihood that we could actually see wages start to grow up. And this has been the real conundrum, the real puzzle for economists and people who study these numbers closely, is that normally when the unemployment rate gets to a level that it's at right now, companies start having difficulty hiring people, and so they have to start offering more money to entice people to come work for them or leave another job and come work for them. Oftentimes the way to do that is by higher wages. So what's interesting, though, is that that hasn't really been happening, and we're starting to get a bit of an inkling that that might start happening now. There was a report that came out this week from economists who work at companies, and they are saying that they are having to start paying people more. If you look at the numbers in the recent jobs report, what you're seeing is that people who are at the lower end, maybe who don't have a lot of education, or maybe they're in a trade job, if you think about the comments that Nikki made, that actually those wages may be starting to increase, and that's really important because those are people who are not making as much money and perhaps are not benefiting as much from the economy growing the way that it is. And so if those people start to see their wages rise, they'll start feeling better. They could start spending more. That, again, will just keep the economy going.
So, Charlie, an idea there that after more than two decades of stagnated wages in this economy, middle class and maybe lower middle class people in America might actually be about to start to get ahead a little bit. I want to talk about wages, though, in relation to the other costs that people have to pay all the time. We got a listener from Fort Worth, Texas, who wrote to us and said, as the housing market gets more expensive, my wages stay roughly the same. So, Charlie, the question there is, what do we know about wages in relation to all of the other things you have to spend money on? From Fort Worth, Texas, they're talking about mortgages, there's tuition, there's the cost of living, there's even inflation.
Well, inflation has been relatively low. I mean, the wage increases that we've been seeing have been about the same as inflation. So people are kind of just keeping up on inflation. Also, things like energy prices, what you pay for oil and gas or to heat your home, those have been relatively low, and interest rates have been really low. So while home prices may be going up, and that's difficult for those people who aren't seeing their wages going up, because interest rates are low, it does make mortgages more affordable. And so these are all things that have actually been beneficial right now. Obviously, there's a huge amount of student debt that people are burdened with now that they're trying to pay off, and it would really be beneficial if they were making more money, if the economy were doing better. So I don't mean to downplay that, but a lot of the other factors that could really be pinching people, at least when you look at the numbers, aren't indicating it. And, you know, of course, the hope now is that with unemployment as low as it is, people might actually start making some more money and feel better about the economy.
Well, Charlie, let's talk about one other corner of the economy, the stock market. The president loves to tweet about the booming stock market. Here's one listener who's on board.
This is Bruce Bennett from Plano, Texas. There's been a night and day change in the economy from a lethargic recovery to a dynamic growth scenario over the past year. This is happily reflected in my investment portfolio.
Charlie, Bruce looks at his portfolio and he says, there it is, ink on paper, the economy's booming.
I would argue, though, that the stock market has been booming now for years, going back to the Obama administration, really for almost a decade. It has been on the up and up. And of course, there has been a huge surge in the last year. Part of that is because of the tax cuts that just went through. So a lot of companies are happy to see their tax rate go from 35% down to 21%. There's also been a loosening of a lot of regulations and that companies are feeling very optimistic and investors are feeling optimistic about that. But one thing to keep in mind there is only about half of American households own some sort of stock. You know, there has been a broad concentration of stock ownership amongst the very smallest group of people. About 10% of American households now own more than 84% of all the stocks, according to one recent survey. So while the stock market is going up, and that can be a very good thing, especially for people who have 401ks or have really put their money into the market, not all the benefits are necessarily being dispersed to everybody within the economy. And, you know, I think the stock market is often kind of this indicator that the economy is doing well, but the two of them are not connected. The stock market is responding to things that are happening with corporations, and it's not always going to be a measure of what the economy is. But this has been a long time trend. And of course, the worry is, what are those things that might actually send the stock market down? You know, if political impasses in Washington continue, if there's no budget, whatever happens with the Russian investigations, these are all factors that could have an impact on where the stock market goes going forward.
President Trump is likely to be heavily on the economy tonight when he addresses Congress and the nation. Charlie Herman is on the economy now, business editor for WNYC. Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you, Todd.
The reality is that we're in an urgent situation, and the consequences will grow worse each day if we do not act. And if our nation continues on this course, the economic damage will be painful and lasting.
Let's move from the American economic scene now to how the economy is doing in the rest of the world. The economic crisis of 2008 shook the world. 10 years later, every major global economy is growing, but economic growth doesn't necessarily mean equity. And the question is, where is all the new wealth in the world going? We turn now to Stephanie Siegel, senior fellow with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi, Todd.
Well, Stephanie, is the rising tide lifting all of the boats? Who's benefiting? Who's accessing all of this wealth?
Well, the point that you made just a minute ago, that the recovery we've seen has been quite broad-based. So it's emerging markets, it's advanced economies, it's low-income economies that are all doing well in the current cycle. And it's also a fact that we've seen income inequality across countries, and in particular in advanced economies, increasing at the same time we've seen growth picking up.
I mean, the U.S. has seen growth, but a large proportion of that new wealth going to the top. Middle-class wages stagnant for decades in this country. Is that the case in emerging economies, places like China and Brazil? Their middle classes are growing rapidly, right?
Correct. So in the case of China and some other emerging markets, you have seen increasing income inequality at the same time that you've seen increasing overall level of incomes. So I think in those cases, you see kind of a rising tide raising all boats. The reason that advanced economies are different in this case is growth is slower, so you still have a growing economy, but that increasing income inequality means that the gains are accruing more to the top. And until very recently, folks at the bottom are actually not seeing their overall incomes increasing.
Well, let's look outside of the industrialized countries in Europe and the United States. Are there countries in this world economic boom that are doing a better job in using economic growth to improve the condition of the poor?
Well, I think it's a fairly mixed bag across EMs. I think the case is, as I was mentioning before, some of the EMs that have seen the most rapid growth, and China kind of comes to mind immediately, you have seen there as well this increasing income inequality.
EMs you talk about, those are emerging markets.
Correct. For those countries that have put in place certain programs to redistribute that wealth, there are some that have actually done a better job. The one that comes to mind there is Brazil, but I would note that you've seen that at the same time that Brazil's economy actually shrunk in 2016 and grew only around 1% this past year. So it's hard to talk about the state of EMs in generalities. I think it's really a function of what's happening in their own domestic economy.
So Stephanie Siegel, we've seen movements in some of the big Western economies, the US, the UK are examples. Tinges of protectionism, withdrawing or renegotiating trade agreements, or in the case of the UK, of course, pulling out of the European Union. What's the effect?
Well, protectionism and those tendencies toward protectionism versus globalism have been with us, I think, forever. So the presence of protectionist tendencies, I don't think, is anything new. But as you pointed out, we are seeing that the appeal of protectionism and really playing to domestic audiences by playing up the ills of globalization has really been a common theme in domestic politics. And so I think it is still very much a real risk. We're looking at how Brexit is implemented. We're looking at NAFTA renegotiations and waiting to see the outcome of that. And we're seeing countries challenge the WTO. So I think those are just examples of where the march of globalization is certainly not assured. And there are some real risks there.
Stephanie Siegel, thank you for being here.
Thank you very much.
Stephanie Siegel is senior fellow with the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
We are seeing a breakdown, and I think we may look back on tonight as the Monday night slaughter of the administration of justice and our institutions of justice in the United States.
The Monday night slaughter, says Carl Bernstein on CNN. Carl Bernstein, who broke the Watergate story back in the early 70s. This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. He's talking about Monday night. News broke that FBI Deputy Director Andrew McCabe is leaving his job. Now, Andrew McCabe has been a favorite target of President Trump. In August, when McCabe was acting director of the FBI, the president tweeted questioning why Attorney General Jeff Sessions hadn't replaced McCabe. The president cited political ties between McCabe's wife and allies of Hillary Clinton dating back to a campaign in 2015. Then NBC News reported yesterday that the president told McCabe in a phone call to ask his wife what it was like to be a loser, because she lost that race in 2015. Here's White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders Huckabee on Monday.
The president wasn't part of this decision-making process, and we would refer you to the FBI, where Christopher Wray serves as the director, which, as I said last week, and I'll repeat again today, the president has full confidence in him and has put the decisions at the FBI in his hands.
Full confidence in the FBI, Sanders says there. But on Capitol Hill, some GOP lawmakers are working hard now to discredit leaders at the FBI and possibly the Justice Department itself. Joining me now is Zach Beauchamp. He's senior reporter at Vox and host of Worldly. That's Vox's podcast on world politics and national security. Zach, thanks for being here.
Hey, happy to be here.
McCabe is gone from the FBI. What do we know? Did he leave under his own power or was he forced out?
So the best story on this that I saw came in the New York Times yesterday. And what the Times reported is that FBI Director Wray had put pressure on him to leave, not necessarily by saying, I'm going to fire you, but by thinking about transferring him, essentially demoting him to a lower job. And McCabe saw this as a kind of intolerable insult. So rather than taking this demotion and then waiting out till his planned retirement in March, he quit 2 months early. Basically, he's on leave right now and will continue to get a salary until March.
Let's put Andrew McCabe's ouster, if we can't call it a firing here, into context of what's going on more broadly. Carl Bernstein on CNN, who has some experience with events like this, called it a Monday night massacre. House Republicans voted yesterday to release a Republican-only classified memo over strident objections of the Justice Department. Nancy Pelosi, the Democratic leader, issued a stark statement saying Republicans had veered into the realm of cover-up. This is all going on while we wait for the results of Robert Mueller's special counsel investigation. Andrew McCabe is now out. So how does he fit into this broader picture, Zach?
This is a big story of Republicans aiding and abetting the president's assault on law enforcement as an independent arm of the government. McCabe is seen by Trump as a political enemy for reasons that were always dodgy. This 2015 campaign thing you mentioned was his wife, not him, and there was no evidence that McCabe was politically biased or in any way acted against the president's interests. Nonetheless, the president sees the FBI and the Justice Department more broadly as an independent source of power that ought to be loyal to him. And he's repeatedly said this. He said this in private. He's essentially said so in public, in interviews, on television. And so all of the events that you were just describing fit a pattern not just of the president saying these things, but of congressional Republicans aiding and abetting him. Many of them have called for McCabe's ouster. This whole release the memo business, the memo is, by all accounts, a poorly constructed document that essentially smears the FBI as fundamentally hostile to Trump and abusing its powers to damage him. That's really terrifying if you think about it.
There were news reports, Zach, that after the president fired FBI Director James Comey in May, he had a meeting with Andrew McCabe when McCabe was being elevated to acting director, and asked him who he voted for in the election. Why would any president ask somebody situated like Andrew McCabe a question like that?
Well, no other president would, as far as we can tell. Maybe Richard Nixon. The reason why Trump would do this is because he deeply believes that the people who work in law enforcement should serve the president in the same way that in his corporations, the people who worked under the CEO serve the CEO directly. This is not the way that things typically work in the U.S. government. Instead, the FBI and the Justice Department are quasi-independent of the executive branch. Technically, its leaders can be fired by the president, but the president doesn't do that as a matter of custom because those agencies provide a crucial oversight role of the rest of the executive branch and even the president personally. Other presidents have recognized this. Trump doesn't, and he doesn't really care about the idea of having checks on his power. In fact, he finds that disturbing. He doesn't like the idea that somebody might look into him. And so he's moving and has been trying for essentially his entire presidency to take control over the independent checks on his authority.
Well, Zach, I mentioned that House Republicans voted yesterday on what you described as release the memo, this Republican-only classified memo that may be released by the end of the week. We don't know what's in it. There have been some indications that it will talk about members of Mueller's investigative team who may have had political biases against Donald Trump, may talk about Andrew McCabe as well, targeting the upper echelons of the FBI. But Zach, is there any evidence that Andrew McCabe has acted in his job in a politically biased way? Now that he's removed, now that he's out, is there any evidence that he's politically biased or has brought that to his job?
None whatsoever. It's that simple. There's just no evidence of it publicly. Maybe something will come out. The reports have suggested that FBI Director Wray was worried about an inspector general report about McCabe's conduct, specifically during the Hillary Clinton email investigation. Who knows? Maybe he was just worried about the political consequences of this report coming out while McCabe had his job. But right now, he has a pretty professional reputation, McCabe, that is. There's no reason to believe that he was abusing his power. And this memo, produced, frankly, by one of the most hacky members of Congress, Devin Nunes, it's not likely to contain damning evidence on that point.
And Zach, we're going to let you run in just a second. But when you look across the leadership of the FBI and the Justice Department, James Comey gone, Andrew McCabe gone. There are reports that Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general, may have a target on his back as well.
it's disturbing. It suggests that there needs to be robust resistance from both civil society and those people in Congress who still retain fears for the American democratic system in what is essentially an attempt to seize control over the Justice Department by the president and allies in Congress.
Zach Beauchamp, senior reporter at Vox. Thanks, Zach.
Thank you.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. More than 300 million people visited the national park system in the United States in 2016, but that's a system that is now under threat. The Guardian newspaper has a new investigative series. It's called This Land is Your Land. They're looking at threats to America's public lands, and their latest report delves into the national park system's infrastructure in dire need of repair. Alistair G. is public lands editor for The Guardian. Alistair, welcome back.
Hi, Todd. Thanks very much for having me.
Well, you and The Guardian have been reporting on the national park system all over the country, from Yosemite in California to Harper's Ferry in West Virginia. Alistair, what's the overall state of the park system now?
Well, national parks are one part of this very dramatic and special tapestry of public lands that are held in trust for the American people and managed by the government. And as you said, they are also very much loved by the American people. But for several years now, there has been this very, very large backlog of maintenance that the Park Service hasn't been able to accomplish in the park. There is now approximately $11 billion of what's called deferred maintenance, which basically means that it was a repair that the Park Service wasn't able to carry out in a given year, and so basically had to add it to a backlog. And so what this means in practice is that you have trails that are closed, you have in one case a cabin that collapsed, in another case you have wastewater systems that are in dire need of repair, or pipelines supplying drinking water keep bursting. And so, as one expert described to me, the National Park Service is in, quote, triage mode. It really does need to take care of these things, but it's not able to.
Alistair, do most people see this disrepair when they visit a national park? Does it affect their hiking or their camping visits or even their drive through the park? Or are they able to sort of pass by without really noticing what's happening?
It depends. So, for instance, one of the most significant repairs that the Park Service hasn't been able to carry out is a pipeline at the Grand Canyon. And it was built in the 1960s, and it supplies drinking water to the entire South Rim, that very popular part of the park. And so if you were visiting the park, you probably wouldn't know that this pipeline is out of order. But it breaks anywhere from half a dozen times to over 20 times a year. It requires crews to helicopter in every time there is a problem to fix it. And each repair can cost as much as $25,000. And I think that it would take $124 million to replace it. So even though a visitor might not see that, that's a really crucial piece of infrastructure that basically means that there is potable water on the South Rim.
Well, Alistair, increases in entry fees are on the table. They have been for several months. How far would that go to cover the kinds of expenses needed for some of the repairs you're talking about?
So Ryan Zinke, the Interior Secretary, has proposed these increased entry fees at 17 of the most popular parks as a way to deal with this maintenance backlog at the parks. And so the idea is, for instance, that for each vehicle, the price would go from around $25 to $30 to about $70 per park. And so, of course, there are concerns that this might put off people with a budget. But also, the folks that I spoke to, some of the critics of this plan, they pointed out that this is projected by the Park Service itself to raise only an additional $70 million a year, which is, of course, a lot of money. But when you consider that $11 billion a year is the backlog, $70 million a year works out to be less than 1% of that number. And so they say, look, this is intended to address this backlog, but it's not going to go very far to do that.
The Guardian newspaper is reporting on the state of public lands all across America. Alistair G. is public lands editor at The Guardian. Alistair, thanks again.
Thanks so much for having me.
For the last 83 years, a board of citizens and experts has advised the Secretary of the Interior on America's outdoor spaces, the national monuments, the trails, and the national parks. Well, 10 of that board's 12 members resigned earlier this month, essentially in protest because Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke refused to meet with them at all in 2017. Carolyn Finney is an assistant professor in the Department of Geography at the University of Kentucky, and she was one of those board members who resigned.
The board's been around since 1935. Our mandate is to meet twice a year. At minimum, what we're supposed to do is help affirm and confirm new national landmark sites. But there's so many more things we do as well. And so in all of 2017, Secretary Zinke did not meet with us. Now, what should have happened, because it happened when Sally Jewell was Secretary of the Interior, is that there's a new Secretary of the Interior. They appoint a new National Park Service director, and they meet with everyone. And so he should have sat down with us, heard what we've been doing for the last 8 years. And look, the first few months of the year, we understood enough to think, look, there's a big transition happening here. We're going to give them some time. But after a while, you know, we follow all the proper channels. We're reaching out. And by October, November, we recognize that, look, they're not going to sit down with us. That's what it looks like. We've tried. They're not going to meet us. So we can either go silently into the good night, or we can use this moment to make a point and really bring up the conversation, because we were really unhappy with the way things were handled.
And the conversation you're hoping to bring up, what's the overall state of the national parks now? Look, if the Secretary of Interior wants to make decisions on his own or in another way, I suppose, as you said, that's his prerogative. But what do you want to say to him that he's not hearing?
Well, we want to say, one, look, he's the Secretary of the Interior, so I say it's his prerogative to the extent that, you know, he has a significant amount of power, and there's a lot that he can do, but the national parks aren't his. The national parks are all of ours, right? They're supported by tax dollars, they're supported by people who go to the parks, people who work at the parks. We care about them. They have a long history here in this country. They mean something to a lot of people. So I would think that somebody would want to sit down and hear what some of those people are thinking and have been doing.
Still, Carolyn, we just heard reports $11 billion in maintenance backlogs to start in the national park system. Do you have specific concerns when it comes to that infrastructure that you mentioned? Would Secretary Zinke be hearing from your board, if it were still in place, about that infrastructure backlog?
Again, we're advisors, right? We can't tell people what to do. These things come up. We talk about the infrastructure, but not a lot, because that wasn't actually, as a board, that wasn't our mandate. You know, that backlog's been in place a really long time. And I would say, yes, it's something that has to be looked at. And it's part of a long list of issues that need to be looked at or that are being looked at, but need to be sustained. I mean, it's really hard for me to answer anything about what Secretary Zinke is doing, because we actually don't know. That's the whole thing. We don't know. We don't know what the agenda is. Of course, they're going to bring in a new group of people. They should. That's the natural progress of things. But we have no idea. Well, that's actually not true. We have a little bit of an idea as a public, right? Because we've seen a few things, like the increasing the price to get into the national parks. But he didn't consult with any of us or anyone about that. And we were all pretty much appalled, because if you think about part of our concern is that we want to make the parks as accessible as possible. And yes, there is that $11 million backlog. I understand the money has to come somewhere. But that's one of the issues that if it sat down with us, we could have at least discussed it and said, you know, if you increase the price, that's going to constrain the ability of all kinds of people to actually take their families out to the park. It's fairly basic, but he didn't have that conversation with anybody. So that kind of unilateral decision is concerning.
Carolyn Finney is assistant professor in the Department of Geography at the University of Kentucky. She's also author of the book, Black Faces, White Spaces, Reimagining the Relationship of African Americans to the Great Outdoors. Carolyn Finney, thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with WGBH Radio in Boston.
nothing went right in the life of Renard Marcel Daniel until he got a 3-judge panel of the 11th Circuit to hear his case.
That's Andrew Cohen, their senior editor at the Marshall Project, with the latest case in point. It's the story of Renard Marcel Daniel, who in 2003 was convicted of a double murder in Alabama. But to understand the full scope of this crime and its journey through the American justice system, you have to go further back in Daniel's life.
It's a horrible story. This is a young boy who, at the age of 3, was in his home when his mother murdered his father. She eventually remarried. Her second husband had psychological problems, PTSD, a former member of the military who engaged in abuse and sexual violence against the children. This is a man, Renard Daniel, who had intellectual disabilities as he went through school, never really helped in any meaningful way. And then he commits a double murder, or at least he's convicted of committing a double murder after a trial in which his attorneys barely offered any defense during the penalty phase. Once he was convicted, they brought one witness to the stand, his mother, even though they had essentially thousands of pages of information and evidence they could have brought on his behalf that might have spared his life.
Renard Daniel was convicted of a double murder, sentenced to death in the state of Alabama. People might not be surprised, Andrew, to learn that Alabama might be tough on people like Mr. Daniel, but what was the problem here?
Well, the problem in the case was twofold. I think it is not a wrongful conviction case. This isn't one of those cases where Daniel is saying that he's innocent, although there were some questions about the evidence against him at trial. This was a problem with his lawyers. And the 11th Circuit, the Federal Appeals Court, which issued the ruling that looks like will spare his life, were really critical of the way the lawyers handled the cases. They didn't talk to his teachers. They didn't go into depth on the amount of abuse he had suffered, the sexual abuse, the physical abuse. They didn't go into detail about his intellectual disability. So not surprisingly, you had this conviction and you had this quick imposition of the death penalty. After the initial trial lawyers went away and they immediately asked to be taken off the case, new lawyers came in and they found all this evidence, all this mitigating evidence that should have been presented at Daniel's trial and wasn't. And so for the past decade or so, they have been trying to get the Alabama courts and then the lower federal courts to basically agree with their assessment that this was one of those cases of bad lawyering. Finally, in 2016, they get this panel on the 11th Circuit. The 11th Circuit says, yes, this is a case where there may have been ineffective assistance of counsel, and there should be a hearing down in Alabama to sort of vet these issues. Once that hearing got scheduled, prosecutors finally relented and decided to send their own state medical expert to test Daniel, to test his intellectual disability, and he scored an IQ of 48. 48 would have rendered him ineligible, I think, for the death penalty. And so prosecutors relented. There is a deal in the works that has to be signed off that would take Daniel off death row and give him a life sentence without the possibility of parole, which is likely what he would have gotten, in 2003 during his trial if his attorneys had done what they're supposed to do.
Well, why wasn't this case of bad lawyering caught within Alabama much sooner? Why did it have to go all the way to almost the top of the appeal system to find a case where a man with a 48 IQ and lots of mitigating factors in his life probably shouldn't be executed?
Yeah, that's a great question, right? And it goes to the heart of the problems with Alabama's justice system. You and I have talked about cases from Alabama where the appellate courts do virtually nothing to overturn flawed decisions by juries or by judges. In this case, despite the evidence against him, despite the fact that he basically presented no defense, the vote was 10-2. Alabama is one of those states where you can have the only state now where you can have a non-unanimous verdict in a capital case. So even with the deck stacked against him at trial, there were still two jurors who would have voted no, who did vote no, and who would have precluded the death penalty. So this is an example of the systemic problems in Alabama, problems that lasted for a decade through the appellate process, problems that even lasted at the federal trial court level, because a federal trial judge in Alabama essentially rubber stamped what the state courts were doing. He was overturned by this 3-judge panel in 2016.
And to be clear, the fact that Mr. Daniel had the worst luck almost imaginable throughout his life is not an excuse for the crimes for which he's convicted.
No.
It's just a question of whether or not these mitigating factors, and in fact,
his intelligence might preclude the death penalty.
Yes, that's exactly right. It doesn't excuse what he did, but there are plenty of people in Alabama and in other jurisdictions who have had similar backgrounds, engaged in similar criminal conduct, had similarly bad lawyers at trial, and who have not been rescued.
But Andrew, is anybody sort of taking a step back in Alabama now, given the fact that Mr. Daniel came up with a 48 IQ, and even in a state that's tough on crime and proud of it, sort of saying, we really dodged a very bad, tragic situation here. You can't execute somebody with a 48 IQ.
Yeah, I don't get that sense, right? I think the U.S. Supreme Court is moving in that direction, right? In the past 15 years or so, the U.S. Supreme Court has begun to restrict the ways in which states can try to execute people who are shown to be intellectually disabled. In 2002, the Supreme Court outlawed the execution of the intellectually disabled, but left it to states to sort of come up with their own standards. And just a few years ago, in a Florida case, the court narrowed that rule a little bit further. So the Supreme Court is aware that this is a problem. And like I say, had there not been a deal, had there not been a settlement between the parties, and had this case proceeded, at some point, some judge somewhere in the federal courts, probably back at the 11th Circuit, would have said, you know what, you cannot execute a man who has an IQ of 48. That is so far below the standards that we talk about when we talk about these close cases that we're not going to allow you to do it. And my sense is that that's one of the reasons why Alabama finally relented and said, fine, we're not going to try to proceed with an execution here. We're going to back off.
Andrew Cohen, senior editor with the Marshall Project. Andrew, as always, thanks.
My pleasure.
The Takeaway is supported by Progressive Insurance, offering Snapshot, a device designed to reward safe drivers. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Now that's progressive. By Staples, offering storage solutions for business, including file folders, banker's boxes, and storage bins for getting organized. More at Staples stores or staples.com. Staples, it's pro time. By Moo, offering print products and 24/7 online customer care service to help businesses of any size. Learn more at moo.com. And Babbel, a language app that teaches real-life conversations in a new language like Spanish, French, and German. Babbel's 10 to 15-minute lessons are available in the App Store or online at Babbel, Babbel.com.
Back in 2016, way before the Harvey Weinstein allegations ignited a movement, one woman looked around her in frustration. American-Israeli writer, playwright, and director Sigal Avin felt bombarded by news in Israel and all over the world of powerful men abusing women.
For me as a woman, it was like, how can this be that women are saying all these things and nothing's happening? And not only is nothing happening, these men are getting promoted and elected and rewarded.
Sigal Avin wanted to translate her frustration into action, so she made a series of short films depicting real-life harassment scenarios to show people what it actually looks like.
We always hear about sexual harassment and read about sexual harassment, but we never get to see it.
Avin's films made a splash in Israel, so she went on to create American versions, teaming up with actor, director, and producer David Schwimmer. Last spring, the two produced 6 short films about harassment, all based on true stories. And now those films are getting a new life as public service announcements here in America, released nationwide, a campaign called That's Harassment. David Schwimmer executive produced the films and acted in one of them, and I asked him why he got involved in this project.
Growing up, I heard countless stories of my mother as a young attorney experiencing several incidents of sexual harassment and sexism. Then my sister, as she entered the workforce, and countless friends and family and colleagues, former girlfriends. Pretty much every woman I know has had an experience of sexual harassment. It was kind of a no-brainer, really. I was like, let's do this.
Sigal, you got started on this project in Israel. These films have real-life scenarios. One depicts a couple of bartenders behind a bar in a casual conversation at first about work that is clearly sexual harassment.
Because you know guys, they'll be getting drunk and they think they can have whatever they want. You know, the whole grab them by the
safety thing, and then it's like out of nowhere, they're like, boom, right there.
Seagal, can you talk a little bit about the process that went into choosing the subjects for these videos? You have to hire great actors, of course, but they really reflect a lot of the subtleties of everyday life where people might skirt through and convince themselves even that harassment isn't going on.
One of my goals was to try to capture that moment, the energy changes in the room. It's almost a moment, it's hard to describe in words, and it's hard to, I think, for anybody except whoever's been through it, even to explain. It's a certain feeling that suddenly something changes in the room. Sometimes it's very subtle. Sometimes you ask yourself afterwards if that really happened. Was that in my mind? And so for that, for instance, it was very important for me that in all the films, the men are not monsters. They seem very nice and polite and funny and people you look up to. I mean, in all the film, David is this wonderful, compelling boss, and the actor is like her friend, which is really heartbreaking when he exposes himself. But I think the subtlety was part of the tools of enlightening the gray area.
Right. I think the films show both those subtle moments, the gray area, such as Cynthia Nixon in the doctor's office, where she came in for one thing, a problem with her sinuses, a sinus headache, and before she knows it, she's having her breasts examined, which she didn't ask for.
Have you had a mammogram lately?
Not in a while.
You should. You have a lovely chest. It'd be a shame not to have it checked.
When you walk into a doctor's office, you are in a position immediately where you're vulnerable, you're placing your trust in someone who has more experience and knowledge.
Do you ever check yourself?
No, I don't.
Should. Here, I can show you. Put this, it's easy. Put your head behind your head. There you go. Turn your head this way. There you go. And you just feel around and circle that.
That subtle dynamic, each of these is an illustration of a power dynamic in which there is a single moment where everything changes in the room. And some are more obvious and overt, and some are more subtle.
David, talk about the importance of men talking to other men about this and hearing from other men.
There's a lot of fear of men speaking out or participating because some people are quick to condemn any man who has the slightest misstep in their opinion or their thought process or their feelings. So the result is everyone's shutting down and shutting up, and that's not going to move the ball forward. You know, we have to create dialogue. So first of all, we have to stop immediately condemning men who are trying to, you know, voice their thoughts, concerns, participate in the conversation. Obviously, men have a lot to learn, and we want to illuminate those and clarify any questions that men have, but you have to invite those questions at the same time. The other thing is, I've been an advocate for 20 years in the area of child and adult victim of sexual assault and sexual violence, and the bottom line is men commit the vast majority of rapes, sexual assault, and sexual harassment, okay? So I believe that men, therefore, have a special responsibility to do something about it. And if you're not actually doing something about it and participating in the conversation in an active way, you're actually part of the problem.
Do you have confidence now that this is a change in culture that's going to stick in American society, in your own industry, for that matter?
Do I think things will really change? I do, but I think it's going to take probably another generation or two, because I think the answer is really hiring more women in all levels of all positions of power and in our government and our representatives. I mean, it's shameful how few women there are that actually represent the country.
Seagal?
And of course, equal payment for men and women. That would be nice if that would happen. Our children who look up and see women fighting and owning their thing is what will make a better generation. And I think we're at a point where women finally really believe that we are equal. I mean, not just fighting and saying we want to be equal. I think we finally really realize we are equal. And until this power dynamic gets even between men and women, I think, you know, I think that's what this movement is about. And I think that's the revolution. And it's incredible. It's pretty amazing. It's a wonderful time to be a woman.
Yeah. I was lucky enough to take my 6.5-year-old daughter to the Women's March just for her to understand and see the kind of empowerment and that women are demanding to be seen and heard in a way that, say, when my mom went on the Women's March, you know, she's carrying the sign of, like, I can't believe I'm still doing this after 50 years, you know. At least for my daughter to pick up the torch or know that it's going to be her responsibility as well to keep the ball moving. I think it's important.
Actor, director, and producer David Schwimmer, and writer and director Sigal Avin, both behind the That's Harassment project. Thank you both for being here.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And you can find lots of resources around the That's Harassment campaign, including a toolkit on how to prevent harassment in the workplace. It's all on our website at thetakeaway.org. That's it for us today, and enjoy the president's speech tonight. Hey, if you're watching the State of the Union, we want to hear from you. 1 year into the Trump presidency, how are you feeling about where the country is? Fill in this blank for us. The state of my union is 8778-MY-TAKE. Record your response for us. In the meantime, thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering storage solutions for business, including file folders, banker's boxes, and storage bins for getting organized. More at Staples stores or staples.com. Staples, it's pro time.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.